Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Food memories are so powerful, they can conquer Alzheimer's, deprivation, and even a community lost to a hurricane. Recipes lost and found today. Do you take vitamins? Well, there's increasing evidence that they're doing nothing for you. Plus, the best bakeries in LA. Jonathan Gold stops by, and we check out urban homesteading. But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're starting off our beautiful spring day here with the rain finally gone, talking with Amelia Saltzman, who, of course, is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, longtime friend of the market, and always on the lookout for fabulous new recipes. And Amelia, I know you've got something great. I can tell by the look on your face.
Here's my favorite Wednesday thing. Dinner in 15 minutes. This is what I've been making every Wednesday for my husband and me. Sort of a nice fish steam poached in a very simple broth. And I'm telling you, start to finish, 15 minutes. One of the things I just love to use from the farmer's market this time of year is cabbage. It's particularly sweet, and I love Napa cabbage because of that frilly texture. It adds something really wonderful in the mouth when you cook and you didn't do any work.
It's kind of the oval, the long one,
right,
with the frilly leaves.
Exactly.
Okay.
So just rinse it off. Don't even pull the leaves off the bunch, the head, and then cut crosswise into ribbons. So I get a nice piece of thick fish from Anjan, too. We're so lucky to have a fisherman at the farmer's market. And you can use, if they've got a white sea bass, you can use black cod. You can find wonderful Napa cabbage, bok choy, green garlic, and that's the young garlic plant before the bulb matures. So a lot of the farmers are bringing that, and you can use the whole plant, which is great. Nice, mild garlic flavor. And fresh ginger, moist, juicy, fresh, delicious ginger. And that's really all you need to turn out a terrific dish. Put a pan of water or broth, whatever you've got, maybe an inch in a small skillet. Bring it to the simmer with a bunch of slivered ginger, a bunch of green garlic chopped. I mean, literally one of the bunches chopped, cleaned and chopped all the way using most of the green. A splash of rice vinegar. I think that's really a nice flavor. Mm-hmm. And I would say for two people, you'd use maybe about 2/3 of a pound of fish. And once the broth has come to a simmer, just add the piece of fish, cover the pan. You know, it takes 10 minutes to the inch of thickness to cook fish. So I would cook this for about 3 to 4 minutes. And then I would open the lid and I would spoon some of the liquid over the fish and add the Napa cabbage. You add some cherry tomatoes if you've got them. Let everything steam very gently, poach gently. And in about 5 more minutes, dinner is done. And then serve it up in soup bowls. You've got this wonderful, delicate, light broth. It's just delicious.
That sounds delicious. And Anjan 2 Seafood is here Wednesday and Saturdays, most days unless the water's been too rough to fish. So she's a wonderful resource, as you said. That was Amelia Saltzman once again at the market, getting inspired and giving us an easy recipe that even we can make at home in 15 minutes, which is even better. One of the things that people might not appreciate is the wonderful qualities of a new potato. And these are these wonderful tubers that grow underground. They're sort of underappreciated, I think, by a lot of people. Alex Weiser has brought the potato into the light of day, and you have just revolutionized everybody's appreciation of potatoes. Let's talk about now what's going on with your potato harvest and what we can find here at your stand.
Well, it's harvest is going real well right now. We have our winter crop, which are set in the ground and have a nice skin on them, and we're digging them as we need them. And also we have our spring crop already coming up. It really doesn't have a skin set on them, and that's what we call a new potato. A lot of people think a new potato is a red potato
or a little potato,
but it's actually any type of potato with its skin not completely set. It can be a big potato, small potato, and you can rub it off with your fingers.
What makes that so much better?
They say it's tender. You don't have to peel it because the skin rubs right off. It's kind of like the same principle as veal, but not as cruel.
We don't tie cruel.
Yeah, we don't tie them up or anything.
I know new potatoes are delicious, and you cannot find them commercially because all commercial potatoes are old.
Right, and the biggest time for new potatoes is springtime, traditionally. We have them in the fall and winter and spring because we have three different crops a year.
Today, I know you grow dozens of different kinds of potatoes, but like I know you got your Yukon Gold and your banana fingerlings and all these, so what are new today?
Well, we have our French fingerling,
oh, yeah,
which is a creamy potato, yellow flesh, red skin, kind of a silky skin. And they're one of my favorite potatoes. They're very creamy. They're versatile. And then we have our Larottes that are in, which is a fingerling-type potato.
It's a yellow skin?
It's a yellow flesh, very rare potato from France.
Mm-hmm. But you dig your potatoes right out of the ground. You're not bringing them in from storage.
Right.
Okay, that's fantastic.
One of the great things about our fall and winter crop is once you have a crop made, you know, you use the ground as your storage.
Mm-hmm.
So the ground stays cold. As long as the ground doesn't freeze, we bury them very deep, at least 8 inches deep, to protect them from freezing weather.
Mm-hmm.
And we can dig them as we need them.
Now, when I get them home, what is the best way? I'm probably going to eat them right away, but if I was going to keep them for a while, how would I store them?
Well, the best way to store potatoes is cool, dry, and dark.
So is the refrigerator too cold?
No, it'd be fine in a paper bag because there is moisture in the refrigerator. The worst thing to do is to put it on your counter in the sunlight.
Okay, because it'll start sprouting.
Yes, and then you can plant them. It'd be my competition.
And then we'll plant them.
That's okay. We don't mind that. Yes.
Right. All right, Alex, as always, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Alex Weiser. And boy, can I not wait to get some of those new potatoes and mash them. Those just sound great. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Get the fish recipe you just heard about and see pictures at kcrw.com/goodfood. Most of us can still remember life before La Brea Bakery. Now fantastic bakeries are literally around the corner. From cupcakes to baguettes to flaky pastries. I'll go through some of the bakers that are getting noticed in Los Angeles. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. It's that time of year when one's thoughts turn to baked goods. Los Angeles Magazine has once again done the kind of roundup that makes you just want to race around the town. With us this morning to sort of take us on a virtual tour of baked goods in Los Angeles is senior editor Margot Daugherty.
There's so many good bakeries in town. I mean, this was really fun to do.
Yeah, there are a lot of good bakeries, and it wasn't always so. Were you surprised at the breadth of styles?
I really was, because I wasn't really familiar with a lot of them, like with some of the Asian bakeries or with the Armenian bakeries. So for me, it was really an eye-opener.
What was one of the notable Asian bakeries?
I loved the Cake House. I think there are two of them now. There's one in the Olympic Collection in West LA, and then there's another one in Koreatown. And that has some kind of traditional French patisserie.
I mean,
styles.
Everything looks very
beautiful.
French and very beautiful. And are the flavors traditional?
Some. The French traditional ones have these kind of whipped cream-infused layered cakes with all these adorable little tops on them, like all kinds of designs. But then there are these more Asian-inspired breads that are interesting because they'll be a really soft bread and then filled with like a pea, maybe a couple of little peas and some pea paste or some azuki beans, red beans. It's really interesting. Oh, and one of my favorites was there's a coffee cake that's infused with coffee.
Oh, what a great idea.
And why did we not think of that before?
So is it a cream that's in the coffee cake?
No, it's not. It's more like a, it's not quite a strudel, but it's like a, it's a perfect coffee accompaniment. It's not too, too sweet. And then it's got this hint of coffee in it.
Wow, that's such a great idea.
Yeah.
And then what about Porto's? Porto's has been around for a long time.
Porto's is so much fun. I mean, it's such a scene there beyond being a bakery. It's just a really fun restaurant because it's such a great amalgam of people. It's full of energy. And they have really great Cuban pastries. It's a family-owned business. So lots of guava jam and really interesting cookies, things that you really don't see anywhere else that have a real kind of homespun feel to them.
Mm, yum.
Yeah, delish.
What are some of the more sort of European-based bakeries that maybe we haven't heard of, maybe some of the newer entrants?
Well, there's a brand new one in Culver City called Platine, and that's run by a chef named Jamie Cantor, and she does delicious stuff like itty-bitty brownies with caramel topping, and she does great cookies.
What about the whole macaron thing, the French macaroon that has taken the city by storm? Has anyone actually opened a bakery that just specializes in that?
There is one now called Paulette in Beverly Hills, and I think one of the appeals of the macaron is that they're beautiful.
Oh, they're so beautiful. The colors
exactly.
are amazing.
And I think everyone's outdoing themselves with, you know, wilder, crazier flavors and colors. And to just go into this shop where they're all on this, I think it's a tiered white shelf, and it's just every color under the rainbow, and it's very pristine in there, and you just feel like you're in a little bit of a gallery.
Wow.
But they're really flavorful, too. I mean, these are beautiful, and it's all fresh fruit, kind of farmer's market flavors. And then gin I always love.
Yeah. Talk about gin.
I just love that place because I think that a bakery, like a restaurant, it's just infused with this spirit and the kind of goodwill, hopefully, of the owner, and even more than of the baker chef. But Christy Chu is both, and she's just the loveliest person in the world. And she just makes – it's kind of Asian-French combo, so these like a green tea mousse cake that's amazing.
Now, what about the whole vanilla thing?
Oh, the vanilla bake shop?
Yeah, the vanilla bake shop.
I love the vanilla bake shop also. It's very small, and I was a little bit resistant to go in because I've had enough of the cupcake shops, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But I went in, and oh, it's so much more than a cupcake shop. They do have the cupcakes, and lots of them. And they also have beautiful layered cakes that are kind of an unusual, like a hat box shape. But they make these shooters of things. So it's like you'll have like an itty-bitty key lime pie in a little shooter cup with its own little spoon. So it's decadent, but so tiny, it's not really so decadent.
And Hans is back with Rock and Wagner Bakery.
Yes, and he forever has made the best. I mean, a lot of people are doing this now, but he makes the best pretzel dough, like the best pretzel buns and pretzel twists and sort of like, I don't know, some people who went to Catholic school and we had the hot pretzels in Philadelphia. We had the hot pretzels that they sold out of vinyl bags in the schoolyard.
With mustard?
With the mustard. It's so much better because he's German, so this is like the genuine, it's the real deal. And they tend to be kind of a dark crust, but really a darkish crust, but very thin. And then the dough inside, really pliant and delicious.
And then there's Susina on Beverly.
Which I love. I've always loved that place. They have their itty-bitty cookies, which they're already pretty well known for, I think, that are just perfection. And again, I like the small things because you feel like you can try all sorts of them without stuffing yourself. But also, if you did want to stuff yourself, they have this banana cream pie that's just amazing. It's so creamy, like really rich, but so good.
Margot Dougherty from Los Angeles Magazine gives her list of best LA bakeries. We've got the list at kcrw.com/goodfood. Add your own favorite bakery in our new comments section at the bottom of the show page. I always love hearing from you. Here's another topic that might cause a little hostility, vitamins. They're taken faithfully by so many people. I'm sure you've taken a few kinds in your life. Well, the bad news is that studies are showing that those vitamins aren't doing anything for you. I'll give you an update when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. Since you've been a little kid, you've been told that a vitamin a day is the key to good health. But is taking a calcium pill the same as drinking a glass of milk? How we ingest vitamins is a source of controversy. Dr. Will Clower, the founder and president of Mediterranean Wellness, is with us to break it down. There's a lot of studying going on right now about this issue of the efficacy of taking a pill versus ingesting the elements naturally.
That's exactly right. And over the past year or two, there's just been a slew of data studies that have come out around the use of vitamins and whether or not their claims of health are valid. One of the issues that we run into is that the supplement industry and vitamins and herbal supplements, they don't have to go through the same process of regulation that food does. And so the bar is much lower because of that. Sometimes claims can be made that aren't substantiated until after it gets into the population for a long time. And so we've been advised to take vitamins since they figured out how to stamp Fred and Barney and Wilma and Dino into a vitamin, yeah. You know, forever. And now what we're reading from every angle is that, by and large, vitamin supplementation can be either irrelevant or harmful. The Physician's Health Study, these are massive studies, 14,000 doctors over 8 years. What they found is that when people took vitamin C and E, it had absolutely no impact on your likelihood of improving your heart health. The only effect was that the people who took vitamin E were 75% more likely to have a cerebral stroke. With vitamin B, it was the same thing. 5,000 women, 7 years taking vitamins B6, B9, B12, no improvement in your cardiovascular health. For selenium and vitamin E, 35,000 men, no effect, except for that the people who were taking the selenium and vitamin E were more likely to get prostate cancer. What seems to be the case is that the supplementation, when you get your vitamins in the form of a abstracted pill, it doesn't do the same as when you take it in the form of food. It's just like beta-carotene, right? I mean, if you eat foods with beta-carotene, pumpkin, squash, carrot, your chances of getting breast cancer plummet. But if you abstract it into beta-carotene, the pill, then there's no difference.
I wasn't surprised to start reading all of this, because when you think of how complex the human organism is,
right,
it seems sort of intuitive to imagine that the actual foods are going to be optimal for us rather than something conceived in a lab.
That is so right on. Because think about your body, Evan. It is the way it is because of the development, like to your point, over millions of years in association with the food that grows on this planet. It knows carrot. It has never seen abstracted beta carotene. It knows nuts. It has never seen abstracted alpha tocopherol put into a gelatin caplet and called vitamin E. It's never seen it. It has no biological context for that.
Now, what about foods that are fortified with vitamins? Is that just an additional
marketing?
Waste of money?
Well, yeah, you know, it's hard to say definitively, but from the data, from the studies, it seems like it is. Now, there's a lot of sensitivities around vitamins and supplementation because it's like a $13 billion industry. There are people who will wrestle you to the mat to say that vitamins are great for you. And there's other people who will say that they're irrelevant or harmful. As a culture, we point to science as our final arbiter of how to know what to do, how to know what to put in your mouth. And yet, science comes down on both sides of this. Each side can point to science and say, yeah, but what about the studies showing that vitamin E helps to prevent stroke? And the other guys say, yeah, but there's this other study that says vitamin E causes stroke. And so it makes it hard for you and I, relative to vitamins, to know what to do.
For years, this was your area of specialty, was studying studies.
Right.
So you know which studies are the studies that can be believed in terms of being really serious, double-blind, huge population, as opposed to studies that are perhaps underwritten by the very same people who produce the goods.
That's correct. So if I were to go out on a limb and say, if you look at the most reliable studies, the bottom line is that we probably should not take vitamin supplements. You need to get your nutrients from your food. A principle is pills are for sick people. If you're sick, if you have a broken physiology, then you need your meds. Don't be silly, right? But if you have a basically normal physiology, it's bad for you to take the multivitamins. It's bad for you to take these supplements that these massive studies are showing are either a waste of your money or, worse, bad for you.
Well, it's nice to know that we can save some money making ourselves feel just the same.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Will.
You're welcome. Great to talk to you.
Dr. Will Clower earned his doctorate in neuroscience. He now spends his time teaching Americans to change their eating habits to a more healthy lifestyle. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to read some links on the latest studies and, of course, to comment on this topic. Food is powerful, especially when we don't have it. Memories of foods our family shared can't be erased by dementia, deprivation, or other kinds of hardship. So when the community of New Orleans was ripped apart, a whole food life disappeared. The Times-Picayune newspaper set about to retrieve those recipes and at the same time retrieve a community. More on that when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. Anybody who's ever been to New Orleans knows how rich and deep the culinary history is. When Katrina hit in 2005, thousands of people lost their treasures, which, of course, included recipes. Thankfully, the archive at the Times-Picayune New Orleans Daily survived. When residents began rebuilding their lives, they turned to the Times-Picayune to find their old family recipes. Judy Walker's the food editor at the Times-Picayune. She and Marcel Bienvenu compiled 250 of the recipes in Cooking Up a Storm. So where did the recipes come from?
Well, the recipes came from many sources. Many of them did come out of our archive. They were recipes that people had clipped out of the newspaper, and they had become family favorites. And many of those were originally given to us by other readers. So that was one source. Many of the recipes had been printed in Marcel Bienvenu's column and in Food Stories.
When you started this process, when people started calling the newspaper and asking for recipes, first of all, were you surprised at the number of people that were looking to you for some lost recipes?
Not really, because, like everybody else in our city, our people on our newspaper staff had lost everything too, or, many of them had. So we knew there was a great need out there for all kinds of information that our newspaper was able to supply. So, and the recipe column had existed at our newspaper for quite some time. It just sort of took on a whole different flavor and became much more popular in the aftermath of the federal flooding.
And were there any particular recipes that had an unusual number of requests?
Well, one of the recipes, two people asked for the same day, and that was the sweet potato corn and jalapeno soup. And then eventually, after we decided we were going to do this project, after about a year, we did announce to our readers that we were going to have this cookbook, and several people did write in and request for some of the same things over and over again. Several of the crawfish dishes like the crawfish pie. I think there were like numerous requests for that recipe.
Let's talk about the importance of food in general to the culture of New Orleans and how Katrina sort of magnified that relationship.
Well, what happened, I eventually realized that what this whole project meant was that New Orleans does have an intact food culture that has lived on and is still thriving. It's been in place now for hundreds of years, and it has continued to evolve. The restaurant culture, of course, is justly famous in New Orleans, but a lot of people do not realize that home cooks here are just as familiar with the food. Men cook here. People learn to cook at a young age. Everybody cooks and everybody knows how to make stuff. So when people were in exile after Katrina and could not return to their homes, could not get the ingredients they were familiar with, it became something they longed for, these familiar recipes. We do have a recipe in the cookbook for red beans and rice. This was the one thing that people longed for the most. People knew how to make gumbo and jambalaya from memory, and they could get a lot of those ingredients or substitute ingredients wherever they were living in the United States. But they couldn't find Camellia red beans, and that's the brand here everybody eats. And it is served in every kind of restaurant, from a diner to fine dining places. People make it in their homes. It's served in the cafeteria, the Shea Picayune, at the newspaper. And everybody eats red beans and rice on Mondays. And so that comes around very often, once a week. And so people were longing for it and talking about it and thinking about it. And it came to stand for what the food really means to people. And people really cherished their food and their recipes more after Katrina because they realized there was so much that could have been lost.
Now, when I think of New Orleans, I think not only of home cooks and of great restaurants, but I think of the little mm-hmm. places in sort of dilapidated wood clapboard houses that are almost like homes that people would sell food out of. Is mm-hmm. that happening again? Have new ones come on to the scene?
Yes, but not as many. Not as many. Yeah, we did lose a lot of those.
What is it like right now, the food scene in New Orleans? Has it rebounded?
Oh, yes. It's more vibrant than ever. And I think that's because people realized that we can't take any of this for granted anymore. We have to, you know, hold it dear, and we have to keep working at it. I know for a fact there's more restaurants now than there were before Katrina, and I think the home cooks are doing their thing. You know, we never run out of occasions to celebrate, so people are still cooking.
Thank you so much, Judy. This has been really a great conversation.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Judy Walker's the food editor at the Times-Picayune. She and Marcel Bienvenu compiled 250 of these recipes in Cooking Up a Storm, Recipes Lost and Found from the Times-Picayune of New Orleans. Here's an old-time favorite that you might have eaten with Mom, carrot cake. Fine Cooking Magazine asked the question, carrot cake, yes or no? For me, the answer is definitely yes. Next on Good Food, carrots, cake, and their secret union. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I have to admit that I was never a big cake fan. And frosting? Yuck, too sweet. Pie was my birthday choice. That is, until various friends' moms started making carrot cake with cream cheese frosting. What a concept. Rich and moist, spicy cake with sweetened cream cheese on top. Yum. Abby Dodge is a contributor to Fine Cooking Magazine and the author of The Weekend Baker. She's here to talk about a carrot cake smackdown between the classic and the new. Hi, Abby.
Hi, Evan.
So was there an actual moment that we can document the beginning of the carrot cake phenomenon?
Well, I think the first actual recipe that appeared in a cookbook in the United States was in like 1929. And I think the title of the cookbook, it's a classic, you know, was like 20th Century Bride's Cookbook. You know, what we know now really, you know, with the cream cheese frosting and all of that, really, that really started coming around in the 60s, early 70s. And in the 70s, it became iconic. It became a classic. You know, I think every wedding I went to in the 70s, the bride always chose a carrot cake.
So what are the elements that create the classic carrot cake?
This is somewhat controversial because I think every family has their own version of the classic. But according, you know, carrot cake, according to Abby Dodge, consists of finely grated carrots and lots of them. This carrot cake that I made has over a half a pound of carrots in it. I also add in walnuts inside the cake, and raisins or currants. Currants are a little bit smaller, sometimes easier to manage. It depends on what I have in the pantry. And then a whole boatload of great spices, cinnamon, ginger, nutmeg, oil, brown sugar, which gives it a little bit extra nudge and little tanginess from the little bit of molasses.
And then the frosting, of course. I mean, you could almost eat anything, I have to say, with cream cheese frosting on it.
Normally, it's cream cheese with a little bit of butter mixed in. But I have to say, I've upped the amount of butter so to give it a little smoother, a little softer, a little fluffier. It's not that dense, thick kind of paste-like cream cheese frosting that we can sometimes remember or have had from, you know, bakeries back in the day. This is lighter and... You know, I think, you know, I could smear it on my toast in the morning.
So I guess we're fine cooking that you asked a pastry chef and owner of a food and wine bar in New York City, Jahangir Mehta, to come up with an updated version.
Yeah, actually, I think this is a really fun new component of the revised and up-to-date fine cooking where we take a classic and pair it with a deconstructed or with a whatever version of that classic. And I think this first one that we did with the carrot cake is super fun because it's very visual. And the pastry chef's version is just this wonderful, very groovy, very cool, and I have to say, I think very sexy update. He uses concentrated carrot juice instead of, you know, the shredded carrots within the cake to kind of really up that carrot flavor. Now, I'm not saying I don't like mine best, because I do, but his is really creative, and as fancy and sophisticated as it looks, it's still very easy for the home cook to make.
We should say that it's like a tubular cupcake.
Yeah, kind of like a timbal or maybe even like a baba au rum for those, you know, that think back to classic French.
And does it have the same type of extremely moist crumb?
It's a little bit more tender, but he uses what gives it the moisture is that he uses he tops these little timbales with candied carrot julienne and uses that syrup from the candied carrot to really soak in into the little cakes, and then adds a dusting of pistachio, you know, that super greens, to really accent it.
I love this. So this cake almost has roots in a Middle Eastern cake in which it's soaked in syrup and topped with pistachio.
Exactly. And it still has great spice flavors in it. What he's using allspice, star anise, and some cinnamon to really punch out those flavors. But it does have its roots in the classic.
It seems that that's what a lot of the new generation of bakers are doing, is taking these classics that we all know and love and tweaking them.
Yeah, I mean, I like that. And I, you know, I'm all for improving flavors and taking things an extra, more contemporary step. I think it makes food fun. I think it makes food vibrant. And it really keeps us interested in food.
Abby, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Abby Dodge is a contributing editor at Fine Cooking Magazine. She's the author of a number of baking books, including The Weekend Baker and the newest, Around the World Cookbook. Register your vote on carrot cake, old school versus new school. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Jonathan Gold knows all schools when it comes to where to eat in Los Angeles. He's with us next to tell us where he's been eating lately. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. It's time for Jonathan Gold to introduce us to something new in Southern California eating. We love that time. Where are we going?
We are going to Beverly Hills adjacent, I think.
Oh, Beverly Hills adjacent. North, south, east, or west?
East.
East.
Definitely east.
Okay.
To the new restaurant called Bazaar by Jose Andres.
What a fabulous guy.
He's a great guy, and his restaurant Haleo in Washington, D.C. is probably the best Spanish restaurant in the country at the moment. It's just great.
So how is Bazaar? Is it Bazaar?
It lives up to its name.
How so?
As probably most people know by now, Andres is maybe the primary American protege of Ferran Adrià, the mad Catalan chef who does everything in cooking except for actually cooking.
The mad scientist of the kitchen.
Exactly. Bazaar is, you know, barring a few experiments by Ludovic Lefebvre at the Old Bastide, the first place in town that really plays with molecular gastronomy sort of things. And I know Adrià hates the term molecular gastronomy. I'm sure that Andres does also. But you go into the restaurant, which is a strange enough place as it is. It's enormous. There's a side called the Red Side, which I guess is the more traditional Spanish sort of small plates cooking. And then there's the Blanco Side, which is the stranger manifestations of new Spanish cooking.
Because his cooking, his just straight ahead Spanish cooking, is pretty unbelievable.
Unbelievable. This place is trying a little bit too hard in the amusing snacks department, I think. For example, you go in there and you order a mojito, and they bring out this glass with a big sort of thicket of cotton candy in, and they pour the drink over it, the cotton candy sweetens a little bit, but obviously the thing's the show. They do a margarita with what they call salt air, which is froth. We've all had margaritas with froth on the top, except this is more intellectualized froth. It's conceptual froth, but it tastes like a margarita. He has a deconstruction of a ensalada caprese that involves little plastic pipettes, you know, the kind that your doctor would draw tiny blood samples from you, I guess, or you would use in a laboratory, that are filled with a emulsion of mozzarella. The business end is impaled into a cherry tomato. which is topped with a tiny leaf of, I guess they call it micro basil, right?
Don't you think there's a role for this?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's great. I'm all for having food be amusing, and it's very fun. And I sort of wish that they weren't serving tomatoes in January. But it's the dish, and it's what they do. There's another dish that they do that is brilliant in concept, where they grill melon and serve it as sort of like the basis of a small salad. And I can imagine it in the middle of summer with a beautiful, ripe, luscious melon having all these characteristics that would make you plots with pleasure. In December, maybe not.
Maybe it'll take him a couple seasons to understand what we have to offer here.
Right.
That's a little different than D.C.
Yeah, they're not doing the seasonal produce thing, and they'll figure it out, I think. But that being said, a lot of it's really fun. Like somebody walking by with, again, sticks of cotton candy, and you bite into it, and in the middle of this ball of cotton candy is a nugget of foie gras mousse. And it's a decent foie gras mousse, and the cotton candy doesn't hurt it much. There's, I think they call them miso noodles, but it's basically a broth with a dashi broth, a little miso in it that's gelatinized, cut into noodles, and then served with salmon caviar. And it must be salmon caviar. I can't figure out what else it would be. It's amusing and it's fun to look at. It would probably be better if they made it with actual noodles and a miso sauce. And it would have tasted better, but it wouldn't have been as amusing. So it's hard to know.
Did you eat on the red side yet?
I did not eat on the red side, but in point of fact, you can eat anything in any part of the restaurant. So whereas they may suggest that you move around and have this on this side and this on this side, some of the best food I had was, I guess, from the red side. I mean, they do a very nice sort of like braised lamb that they put into you'd have to call it a foam of mashed potatoes, but when it comes down to it, it's just like lamb in a nice sauce with mashed potatoes. They have really good conservas, the super high-end Spanish preserved foods, including delicious olive stuff with anchovies, which are good. I mean, they're completely delicious. And it's interesting to eat them alongside the sort of New Wave olives, which I guess is an Adria thing, which is olive juice and puree with the algament that's dropped in until it becomes this sort of a wobbly sphere with a very thin sort of rubbery skin that you bite into and get the whoosh of olive juice. Everything's about whooshes here.
It's very sensual food.
Very sensual food. You can get a martini with that in it too. But in the end, the taste that I remember the best and the thing that I carried away with me was the slivers of bayota ham, the wonderful, totally acorn-fed hams from Spain that have fat that melts at temperature lower and just dissolves in your mouth in this rush of wonderful pigginess. And I must say that that's a technology that's 3,000 years old.
That's true. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hear food writer Jonathan Gold nearly every week on Good Food and read his column each week in the LA Weekly. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for the address and details of today's spot. Remember home ec? I took it while all the boys took shop class. Now you can't find many home ec classes. They've been turned into nutrition classes instead of cooking lessons. My next guests think this is all wrong. Kids need to learn how to churn their own butter and pickle vegetables. The urban homesteading movement. In this economy, it sounds like a pretty good idea. Stay tuned to KCRW and I'll tell you more about it. I'm Evan Kleinman. You're listening to Good Food and I'll be right back. Home ec classes. They're a thing of the past, but should they be? Eric Knudsen and Kelly Coyne don't think so. They're authors of The Urban Homestead and the blog Homegrown Evolution. What is an urban homesteader? Well, it's someone who knows how to keep house the real way. Think sewing your own clothes, picking vegetables, and cooking from scratch. I find it so interesting that the home arts are just, nobody knows how to do anything, and people just poo-poo this whole idea, like we should just all plug ourselves in and expect things to get done.
Well, it just makes sense. I mean, economically, but also, you know, for me, these things like canning food and growing your own food are really about pleasure and about the kinds of things that actually this show is about, good food, right? It's about the flavors of food before things were all wrapped up in plastic in the supermarkets. So why not do these things? Our great-grandparents did these things, and it's just it's time to bring them back again, not just because the economic times are bad, but because it's really about just pleasure, the pleasure of life, the pleasure of food.
Our friend David Kahn says that we're the only species who can't feed itself, and that's a sobering thought.
It is a sobering thought.
Yeah, we want to reclaim this knowledge before it's lost. It used to be commonplace, not special, and in many parts of the world, it still is commonplace, commonsensical knowledge. But here in the industrialized West, we've almost lost this whole sort of foundation of basic knowledge on how to take care of ourselves, and we'd like to start to reclaim that.
And your motivations to really get involved and sit down and write the book, is it financial? Is it political? Environmental?
It's all about pleasure. I just have to say that over and over again. For me, it's not a political thing. The political thing maybe is a side effect of that, but it's about the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, we started doing this to please ourselves and to live the way we wanted to and to get the kind of produce we wanted to. We have chickens because I didn't like the quality of the eggs that came out of supermarkets. I mean, it just sort of happened, you know, just naturally, organically, as you might say. And we started keeping a blog about what we did.
For me, like, another reason to grow your own food is to get in touch with the place that you're in, the climate that you're in. And we're in this here in Los Angeles. We're in this wonderful Mediterranean climate. So the things that we have around our house, fig trees and pomegranate trees and the kinds of Italian vegetables we grow, tie us to the place in a very meaningful way.
So give us some ideas of how somebody who really wants to start but feels kind of overwhelmed, what can they start doing?
Just something small and symbolic. I mean, by no means do we grow all our own food. We just started with a small vegetable bed, 4 by 8 feet. But someone in an apartment can grow some herbs on a balcony. And for me, you know, it's these symbolic actions that are so important in our lives and that carry through in our lives and our communities. So, you know, I always say don't try to do too much all at once. Just start with something small. Maybe you don't have any space to grow food, so you make beer in your kitchen, right?
What about some other ways of preservation, like dehydration? I don't have a dehydrator, and I've thought about it. It must be a pretty easy way to sort of get started.
Yeah, and that's another thing with being connected to this place. It's a hot and dry place. So in the Mediterranean, people dry food, and we do here too. We built a thing called a solar dehydrator, and there's plans on the internet for doing that. You can build it out of cardboard boxes. And it's
I understand it's on your roof.
It's actually on the roof of our garage. We have a solar dehydrator, and in that we dry tomatoes, and we have excess tomatoes from what we grow, and figs. And it's great. It's another, I mean, there's so much of an emphasis in America on canning, and canning is great, but there's also drying food. There's also pickling food, lacto-fermenting food.
So when you talk about urban homesteading, a lot of times people think about, you know, the little house on the prairie. You need, like, acres of land to, quote, homestead. You've pretty much brought the concept to life here in Los Angeles.
Well, actually, you know, I actually don't even like that term because of the Little House on the Prairie Association. And again, for me, it's just about living a pleasurable life. And it's really about common sense. You know, for us, we have a small yard. We could have grass in it, but why water grass in Los Angeles? Why not have some vegetables? Why not dry some figs in the dehydrator on the roof. It's just all these common sense things. We have four hens, and we don't have to buy eggs at the supermarket, and the eggs taste better.
And I noticed on your blog that they were eating some termite larvae.
Indeed, they have side benefits. We had a swarm of termites.
After the rains, you know how they come out in the billions, and we let the chickens loose on them? It was satisfying.
No more termites.
That's great.
But it's pretty basic. I mean, we're not doing anything special. We have a few vegetable beds. We have a chicken coop. We have a compost heap. That's it.
It doesn't look like Versailles.
It doesn't look like Versailles, and it doesn't look like Little House on the Prairie. It just looks like a house.
What I'd like to see ultimately is, you know, I keep the chickens. My friend in the apartment makes the beer. We trade, right? That kind of thing I'd like to see get going here.
In the city, it's all about community.
It's been really wonderful to meet you. I love your blog. Great book. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Evan.
Eric Knutson and Kelly Coyne are the authors of The Urban Homestead. They also write a blog called Homegrown Evolution. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for info on how to start your own homestead. Maybe you're not quite ready to create your own urban homestead, but an economy like this can force you to reconsider your livelihood. To start a new gig as a caterer or a cookie maker, the law requires that you have to have a commercial kitchen. That can be expensive. So we're showing you an alternative. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. It used to be a nightmare in this town to find space to develop and produce a handmade culinary product or maybe to prep a catering gig. You may not have the 100 grand or more to spend on a new professional kitchen. Well, there is a wonderful resource out there now for budding chefs. It's called the Chef's Commercial Kitchen Co-op in Los Angeles. Andrea Bell runs the facility. Describe the space that you have.
We have five fully functioning commercial kitchens. And each kitchen has everything you need to walk in and start cooking. So we have convection ovens, we have commercial ovens, we have large work tables, Hobart mixers, all of the equipment necessary to walk in and produce whatever type of artisanal product you are planning on making.
Even pots and pans and whisks and spoons?
We let most of our chefs bring their own small equipment, especially their knives and things like that, because it all changes. Although we do have pots and pans and spoons and whisks, most people bring their own things, and everybody has an individual rolling storage container to keep their individual equipment and their small equipment.
Do you tend to have sort of drive-bys where people will come and use it for a specific period of time and then go away and never come back? Or do people tend to come in on a more regular basis?
We primarily have people that use our kitchens on an ongoing basis, although we do have people that are just getting started. Let's say they're selling their famous chocolate chip cookies at the farmer's market, and they've just gotten into one market. But we have many people in a variety of different areas who are getting their feet on the ground and little by little are getting more and more hours, and people that have really stayed for many years. One of our first tenants that started out selling her tamales in the park, which wasn't completely legal, has been with us and is now in something like a dozen farmers markets. And her tamales are more popular than ever, and she's working away in our kitchens. So, for instance, many people that are opening restaurants that use our kitchens to test their recipes, to really fine-tune things, and then go on and open a restaurant, so they move out.
What about small manufacturing? What about jarred products?
We have people that do that and sell them to Trader Joe's and Gelson's and Whole Foods, and they have the specialized equipment themselves to be able to do that.
Wow, that's just incredible. Is this what you call a kitchen incubator?
It is a kitchen incubator. It's a place where people who have ideas and want to be in the food field but need a place to really get their roots started, they can come in pretty much with their ideas and be able to develop them and then market them and then maybe grow enough so that they can move on to a larger kitchen or their own kitchen. And we've had people that have done that have sold their items at Costco and throughout the United States, or other people who have stayed with us and just marketed their products from our kitchens on the internet, even personal chefs who come in several days a week and make deliveries, people that make organic baby food, vegan cheesecake, a variety of small products that that they sell throughout the city, throughout the country.
How is it different from just renting a kitchen?
Well, we provide everything for them, and they also have a lot of usually renting a kitchen, first of all, for somebody who's really a small business, a small food business, is very, very difficult. Kitchens just aren't available. And the health department's rules and regulations make doing that for somebody that's just getting started almost financially impossible. The costs are just enormous, and we're able to keep our costs at a real minimal so that people really can get going. As you mentioned, $100,000 is easily a beginning amount to get your foot on the ground, and most people who are in the food business don't necessarily have that kind of money socked away that they can get started. So people can walk in without really, you know, with just a few thousand dollars, and they can get going.
Now, Andrea, I know that you had a catering company for years and years and years. So is this your retirement package?
Well, I'm not sure if I'd call it that. It was a wonderful way of giving back to a lot of people who are just getting started. It was a way of using all of the equipment and all of the, I guess as I was working, I put the money that I earned back into my kitchens, and it was a way of sort of giving that to other people and helping other people get started. I myself worked in a closed school kitchen, putting cutting boards on top of chafing dishes to do the chopping and cutting, et cetera, for my catering business when I was getting started. A lot of people get started in their own homes, which is illegal. And so once I was able to develop my own kitchens and work for 25 years in them, it was a wonderful way of then giving them back to other people who were trying to get started. You have to love what you're doing in this field because it's a tough field and it's a lot of hard work. But people that want to be it can be in it. And this is one of the ways.
Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you.
Andrea Bell runs the Chef's Commercial Kitchen Co-op in Los Angeles. Find more info at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm collecting fans on Facebook. Add me, Evan Kleiman, to your profile. Also, did you know that you can embed this show on your blog or webpage? Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click Listen. You can read the Good Food blog there, too, and post a comment on the show. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Gary Masiha is our music supervisor. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.